TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Birzad Yachmayan. The Secret World of Refugees. Part 2. Birzad Yachmayan is an international political economist and the author of Social Change in Iran, an Eyewitness Account of Dissent, Defiance, and New Movements for Rights. He's a frequent contributor to the magazine Counterpunch. You can find his intensely personal articles at counterpunch.org. He's currently in the Middle East, researching for his upcoming book, Embracing the Infidel, The Secret World of the Muslim Migrant. They say the world changed after 9/11, but surely more so for some than others. It wasn't easy being a Muslim migrant prior to the World Trade Center attack. Afterwards, the experience is akin to living inside a Hitchcock movie. An existence lived under unrelenting scrutiny, police surveillance, daily harassment, and public paranoia. Birzad Yachmayan's writing gives us a vital wake-up call to this unfolding human crisis. A moving first-hand account of what it is like to walk in the shoes of these innocent suspects. Jeffrey St. Clair, author and editor of Counterpunch, wrote this about the upcoming book, The Secret World of the Muslim Migrant, by Birzad Yachmayan. The tragedy of migrants and refugees is that the West often created the conditions such as fundamentalism, repressive regimes, militarism, globalization, economic and social hardship that move millions every year to flee their homes. However, when they arrive in the countries that caused their despair, they are often not welcome. In fact, all Western countries, such as the U.S., Australia, Canada, and all European countries, have recently restricted immigration and deported even those who fear persecution or starvation. The events of 9/11 created a climate of terror for migrants from the Middle East. Birzad Yachmayan's writing gives us a vital wake-up call to this unfolding human crisis.
I decided to go on the road and to look at the journey of migration. That is, I wanted to see what happens to the Middle Easterns when they leave their home and in the process of finding a new home. That journey for some people takes a month, for other people takes 10 years. For some people, it never ends. They die on the way. Some become eternally uprooted. That is, they hang basically in nowhere between their own country and the country they want to choose as their home. So I wanted to travel with them, to live with them where they are, to tell their stories, to become their voice, people who are actually voiceless. And that is the reason for my book.
Birzad Yachmayan visited New York City in May of 2003 and was interviewed by my friend Patty Heffley on her program Rogue Finch Radio. He begins with a story of an Iraqi Kurd named Tavanah. He escaped the bombing by nerve gas of his village Halabje by Saddam Hussein's army. When his family fled to Iran, his journey began that has not ended yet. Here is Birzad Yachmayan.
The story of M is a very intricate story of love, tradition, falling bombs, brutality, dictatorship, civil war, anything, name it. It is a story of an Iraqi Kurd whose name is Tavanah. Tavanah now is 30 years old, but he's also a victim of war. If you remember, in 1988, Saddam Hussein bombed the village of Halabje in Iraqi Kurdistan. He used chemical weapons, mustard gas, and nerve gas. 5,000 people died on that day in Halabje. And in this recent liberation of Iraq by the White House, the media and also the White House spoke about Halabje repeatedly. They used this as a pretext of going to Iraq and liberating the Iraqis of Saddam Hussein and yet another possibility of chemical warfare. Anyway, at the time of the bombing of Halabja, my friend Tavana was 16 years old. So during the bombing, the family actually escaped the consequences of the bomb. They fled Halabja and they went to Iran. They stayed in Iran for a couple of years until Iraq was liberated. At that time, partially liberated, or northern Iraq was liberated by the Americans. The war was over. This is 1991, the Kuwait War. Tavana's family returned to northern Iraq. So he went back to northern Iraq. But at that time, the northern Iraq for him was too suffocating. It was too small. He had lived in Iran for a while. He could not actually handle the situation there. Then a civil war broke out in northern Iraq between two factions, two parties, two Kurdish parties. He became a Peshmerga for a while, but then he gave up. He said he had to leave. He went back to Iran. He went to Tehran as an Iraqi refugee, not knowing the language, not having any papers. He was totally lonely, alienated, frightened, until a man housed him, helped him, gave him a job, became his friend, gave him protection, gave him money, gave him love that he could not have even imagined. The man became his best friend, his confidant. This proceeded until one day, Tavana went to the house of the man to meet him. He rang the bell, the door opened, and there was a beautiful woman, a young woman. Tavana fell in love, a type of love that changed his life forever. He could not say a word. He stayed there for a minute or two, staring at the girl. The girl stared back, then she walked away. That became the point of rupture, another change in Tavana's life. Tavana never spoke to her again, never saw her face to face, but fell in love with her enormously. He went back to his room, he found out the name of the girl, he thought about the girl day after day, and he started tattooing the first letter of the girl's name on his arm, letter M. He burned his skin with cigarette burns. Every night, he went to his room, he lit cigarettes, he put the cigarette on his skin until the pain was unbearable. Next night, another spot, next night, another spot, until the letter M was fully constructed. The girl became eternalized in his heart and in his body. He suffered a lot of pain, he stayed there, struggling with different emotions, different feelings, different possibilities. He told me in Athens when I met him that there was no possibility for him to actually marry the girl, because to do that he would have had to speak to his friend, to tell his friend that he's in love with his daughter. That, to Tavana, was a betrayal of his friend. He could not have done that to his friend. He could not have taken the girl and run away, because that would have also been a betrayal. So he was in love. He knew that he couldn't betray his friend. He also knew that his friend, even if he wanted, his friend would not allow him to marry the girl, because Tavana was a manual laborer and his friend was a man of money. So here you have the crossroad of class, tradition, love, loyalty, and many different feelings that actually trapped this young man. So finally he decided to run away from love. He took his tattoo with him. He crossed the mountains to Turkey. He went to Turkey. He stayed in Turkey for 3.5 years. Turkey was too suffocating. He crossed the mountains and he came to Athens. I met him in Athens. And the first day we met, he rolled up his sleeves and he showed me the letter M.
That was the story of M, told by Behzad Yahmayan, who's traveling with refugees in the Middle East, collecting their stories and making us aware of the secret world of migrants. The next story is that of an Iranian Kurdish woman. She had to deal with the taboos of divorce and single parenthood.
This older woman, 50 years old, and we befriended, we became really good friends. She told me at one point, I'm the second best friend she has in the world, and the first best friend is also a man from Iran. The woman is an Iranian Kurd who's had a long history of hardship and discrimination as a woman. She escaped Iran because she was a woman. The reason for her to become a refugee was nothing but her gender, her womanhood. At the time of the revolution in Iran, she's a Kurdish woman. She lived in Sanandaj, a city in Iranian Kurdistan. At the time of the revolution, her brother, who was a political activist, a Marxist, a member of a Marxist organization, was killed by the Iranian government. She also sympathized with the organization. She was a teacher at that time. The Iranian government discovered about her activities. They fired her, and they did not allow her to teach ever. So she became jobless at the beginning of the revolution. A couple of years after this, she met a man, and they married. Soon after, she realized that the man was a drug addict. Soon after, I mean, actually, a couple of weeks after the wedding. She goes to her father and says, look, my husband is a heroin addict. I want to separate. The father says, absolutely not. This is a sin. What would I say to everybody else in the town that my daughter is married? 2 weeks later, she returns home. So she could not do that because of tradition, because of the repressive gender relations in Iran's Kurdistan. She lives with the man. She gives birth to a child, Shahu, the boy I met in Turkey with her. 6 years later, she finally succeeds in divorcing her husband. She lives with Shahu, with the family, father, brother, and others. But there was an enormous pressure on her to get married, because having an unmarried daughter with a son was also a sin, was considered to be a shame for the family. Under pressure, she marries again, but this time the husband was an abusive person. He abused her tremendously, and she begged her father to allow her to divorce. The father refused. Finally, she divorces. She lives with her father again with the child, but the conditions were getting worse and worse. She was under pressure. She escapes. She couldn't deal with this anymore. She takes her boy. She goes to Turkey, applies for asylum. The UNHCR waits for 3.5 years. At the end, they reject him. They had no case for asylum. So she was in Turkey at that time. She went to Istanbul, and from Istanbul, they found a smuggler. They paid the smuggler some money to take them to Greece. They wanted to go further away from Iran. They went to Greece. They were arrested by the Greek authorities. They were sent back to Istanbul, a common occurrence for a lot of people. And this is when we met. We befriended. I met these guys almost once a week. I went to their home. I mean, you have to understand, Shahnaz, the woman, and Shahu were very poor. They did not have really any money. They lived in despicable conditions, but they were extremely hospitable. Each time I went to their home, they cooked me dinner, we ate, I brought alcohol, we hung out, we talked. I became their best friends in Istanbul. After a few months that we met, Shahu was arrested by the police, randomly. He didn't have papers. He stayed in jail for 1 week. I visited him in custody, and the police deported him to Iran. So Shahnaz also packed and returned to Iran, to Kurdistan, to the place she had escaped from 4 years earlier. With the day she was leaving, I was with her until a couple hours before her departure. She was very depressed. She didn't know what to tell the family. She was away for 4 years. Now she was returning without anything in her hands. And she was expecting very horrifying conditions. I have not heard from her after that, and I don't know what conditions she's actually experiencing now.
What is your process of finding out these stories? How do you get these intimate stories from people?
One thing I do not do is interviewing people. I don't interview. I don't ask questions. I don't believe these real-life stories could come out in interviews. Interviews are impersonal. There is a power relation in interviews. The person who asks the question and the person who answers, there's a very bizarre relations of power that leads to alienation of the person being interviewed. So I don't do that. I go, I introduce myself very honestly. My name is Behzad Akhmayan. I'm from Iran. I'm writing a book about the journey of migration. I want to tell the world your plights. I want to tell the world what you're experiencing, the horrors of the journey. I want to tell the world about your hopes, your aspirations. And in miraculous ways, people trust me immediately. Somehow, I click with them. I bond, and a connection is built. We become friends, and then there is no obstacles. They follow me. I follow them. We go out. We go drinking. We go to cafes. We drink tea. We smoke Nargila, shisha, water pipe, tobacco. We do anything that other humans do to bond, to become friends. And I become their confidant. I become their best friends, and they tell me their stories, and I write their stories, and I show them what I write. And they're very happy to tell me their stories and to help me tell the stories to the rest of the world. So I've had absolutely no problems collecting stories. I don't even remember a case, a single case, in which a person I wanted to talk to refused to speak to me.
As the interviewer, I feel very powerful. Yes, I do. I have these papers in front of me, and I'm asking questions and getting answers. That's good. Can you just say a little bit about the role of the UN and the UNHCR in alleviating these problems or not?
This is a very long and complex issue, but I want to address only the UNHCR in Turkey. I mean, Turkey does not give asylum to non-Europeans. So when non-Europeans go to Turkey and the Turkish government allows them to register as asylum seekers and ask them to go to the UNHCR, the UN agency. So the refugees, asylum seekers, then go to the UNHCR and file a case for asylum with the UNHCR. If the UNHCR accepts their case for asylum, it would then try to find a country of resettlement for them. So, for example, the United States, Australia, Canada, Britain. And it then facilitates the connection between the asylum seeker and those countries and then the resettlement of these people in those other countries. But what is happening is this. The UNHCR is an institution of power. It is not the government, but it has de facto governmental power. That is, it is the UNHCR that can decide whether this person is eligible to become a refugee or not. So the UNHCR staff that have the power of determining the conditions and status of the asylum seekers often become corrupt. And I've heard horrendous stories of bribery, even physical abuse of asylum seekers, extortion, psychological torture and pressure, insults. I've spoken to many asylum seekers who cried repeatedly when I spoke to them when they talk about the UNHCR. To many of the asylum seekers and the refugees, even those who were accepted by the UNHCR as refugees, the UNHCR is not their friend, it is the enemy. I went to the office of the UNHCR in Van, in Turkish Kurdistan. The office is supposed to be a home for the refugees. This is where the refugees go for protection. The office looks like a fort. It has high walls, barbed wire, guarded by armed people. It is horrifying looking. To me, someone from Iran, it looked like the most notorious political prison in Iran we knew of. Evin prison, the infamous Evin prison. Metal gates, barbed wire, high walls, protected. The asylum seekers are not allowed to actually wait inside the complex, inside the fort. I called it a fort. In Van, there is a dirt field across from the UNHCR. In rainy days, in cold winter days, you see 10, 20, 30 asylum seekers just waiting for their turn to be called to go in, either for the interviews or for whatever. You see women with infants in their arms. Not even a single room for the old people, for the women who have children, for the sick to go and sit down. These are the most basic facilities that an institution that is supposed to help the refugees could create for the refugees. No, that is not created. So that's the conditions the refugees and asylum seekers are actually facing in the hands of the UN, their protector.
What is different for you than for these refugees? I mean, I know you travel under a U.S. passport. Do you suffer the same prejudice being from Iran? What happens with you in your travels?
Well, I mean, I cannot say that I suffer the same type of prejudice and the same hardship that these refugees suffer from because I have an American passport. I have money. I have my credit cards. I have the possibility of doing whatever I want. But when I do cross borders, even with my American passport, because of my place of birth that is indicated in my passport, and also because of my looks. I look Middle Eastern, vividly Middle Eastern. I'm regarded as a terrorist until I prove I'm not. So crossing borders is also a very difficult and a torturous act for me. I'm always stopped, questioned, the most ridiculous and insulting questions. When other people go through the border, like in less than a minute, I'm kept for an hour. My passport is held up, screened, scrutinized, taken from one hand to another, shown to supervisor after supervisor, and I'm kept. I'm asked to go back to ask questions, return, go back, ask further questions. So this is what I go through over and over and over. But at the end, they let me go because I have a legal, legitimate American passport. But going through borders, I always have anxiety because I know this is what I'm going to be facing.
And just one more question. Certainly the world is in complete turmoil right now all over, and this has been so intense, especially since 9/11. People are jumping out of the frying pan into the fire, it seems like, and it seems like there's less and less choices, and they're becoming more violent choices. There seems little hope, in a way. I guess that has to take a toll on you.
Yes. How do I feel? At times, I feel extremely hopeless, extremely depressed. At times, I have to go hide somewhere and cry and go back and proceed. I have nightmares. In my nightmares, I see myself in conditions that I hear in my stories. I want to share with you actually one of those. There was this Iranian family I met in Istanbul, and I befriended them, and they had a 13-year-old son. I became really close to the son. And the last time we met, they told me that they had found a smuggler. They had paid each about $900 to the smuggler to help them go to Greece through the sea. And that was in winter. I told them, look, the sea is rough. This is not the time for crossing through the sea. Wait until the weather gets better. They said they had to go. We talked and talked and talked. I did not see them 2 weeks later. I received a phone call from them. And the mother was on the phone, said, we are arrested. We are in Izmir in the police department. Our boat was capsized. We were almost dead. We were rescued. And she asked for help. That night, I went to bed, and I had a dream. I was on a boat with my family in the middle of the sea. There was nothing but us on a small boat on the sea. There was a storm. The waves were really high. The sea was extremely rough. We were all dying. And I would wake up, go back to sleep, and see the same dream over and over and over. At one point, the dream changed. We were rescued, but then I was on a bus going somewhere with my family. A border police came to the bus, asked me for my passport. I didn't have my passport. He took me away. These are the same stories I hear from my interviewees, quote unquote, the people I meet. I was taken away. I was taken to a building, and then I had to cross through many floors in which there were vicious animals attacking people. I was really horrified. And the guy came to me and said, I have to take you to the 12th floor. Please go with me. So I proceeded going with the guy, but instead of the 12th floor, I was taken to a labor camp. In the labor camp, I saw Africans working under conditions of slavery. They were carrying heavy rocks on their back, a slow motion movement by the Africans. And at that time, I woke up, I walked around, went back to sleep, and saw the same dream over and over. I saw the same Africans. And so these are some of the experiences I have. The traumas actually stay with me. At times, I feel really empowered because I realize, though I'm not doing much, I cannot do much personally for the people whose stories I'm telling. But the fact that I'm their friends itself is an important reality. They need friendship. And I hope by telling their stories, I would be able to somewhat change people's mindsets and create conditions in which citizens of Western countries would be able to pressure their governments for changing their policies towards migrants and refugees. And that gives me power to do the job. Otherwise, the job is difficult. It is a very hard job.
If people want to get in touch with you, again, they can go to counterpunch.org, and your email is there to contact you.
Yes, they need to punch in my name in the search, Yaghmaian, Yaghmaian, and my articles will appear. At the end of my articles, there will be my email, and they can write to me. I will be very happy to talk to people about any of these issues.
Once again, your book is Social Change in Iran. It's available in any of those larger bookstores and online. And we've been speaking to Behzad Yaghmaian. I appreciate your tireless attempts at letting the world know these stories, which I think that the more people know these, the possibility of a few lives changing, at least. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
I want to thank my friend, Paddy Heffley, for letting me use this amazing interview with Behzad Yaghmaian. She talked to him in May 2003 in New York City on her program Rogue Finch Radio. Those of you who have followed the Pacifica Radio Odyssey may remember her name as a co-plaintiff with Carol Spooner on the famous and successful Listener lawsuit. Finding someone like Behzad Yaghmaian in the jungle of the big city of New York is quite typical for Patty. She's a great activist and street performer and rides her bicycle through Manhattan, always in search of amazing people and events. Thank you, Patty. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Behzad Yaghmaian on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this program about the secret life of Muslim migrants by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.